Well met, and welcome to episode 147 of the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for March the 12th, 2017. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we delay the beginning of our podcast discussion of Coriolanus for an interview special. Now, if you're in Southern California in the summertime and you're a Shakespeare fan, and if you're not, why are you listening to this? You've undoubtedly heard of the Independent Shakespeare Company and their free shows in Los Angeles's Griffith Park. Well, last month I had the opportunity to sit down with the founders, Melissa Chalsma and David Melville, in their LA Studio HQ performance space, and they were kind enough to carve out some time for an interview. And the conversation was so wide-ranging that I've had to chop it up into three parts, and today you get to hear the second part. First, as with last month's podcast, a mea culpa. I took my bare-bones recording rig down to LA, iPad and Blue Yeti microphone. Now, the mic's pretty damn sensitive, so any move of it, or it seems around the table on which I had placed the mic, gives us some soft thudding sound, so I apologize for that. Next time, I'm taking the full rig, boom mic stand the whole bit. What I cannot apologize for, however, is the sounds of the Los Angeles Metro rumbling nearby. Those trains are loud. So now, without further ado, here's the second part of my conversation with Melissa Chalsma and David Melville, the artistic director and managing director, respectively, of the Independent Shakespeare Company. So you mentioned that you're going to be doing Measure for Measure, and that sometimes feels like a very current play. Do you have it already figured out, like what setting you're going to use, kind of what buttons you're going to push throughout the production?
I think Measure for Measure is a play that is... Well, it's an odd play in the sense that the humor is, it's very funny. And then also it's just so awful, really, what is happening to these the characters in the play. My thinking on it's changed a lot because of the election, actually. You know, I think that it's a little harder for me just to say, let's play, bring up the humor, because I think it does seem sort of so timely now, that idea. Politicians have always equivocated, and you know, the prime example is, you know, it depends what your definition of is, you know, well, there's only the one, and, you know, mm-hmm. The rest of us know that, but I guess if you say that, you know, and I think that the characters in the play, all of them really engage in this kind of, well, yes, but it does seem to me more, even more timely now, that idea of if you say it, it's true.
Well, it's timely, but, you know, Angelo isn't Donald Trump, he's Mike Pence.
Yes.
Who will probably be the president by the time we do it.
So there you go. Just get him to, like, a wait yeah. again.
That's scary.
But, it is one of Shakespeare's favorite themes, though, that idea mm-hmm. of religious hypocrisy. And the hypocrites who want to banish any fun for everybody else and that kind of thing. So I think that all of those elements. As for the setting, I don't know yet. I don't think we've really settled on how it's going to look or...
For the most part, we don't try to ask people to read too much into mm-hmm. the world that we create on stage in terms of setting. You know, it's still, I thought it was very much a 20th century thing, but it's apparently even more so in the 21st century. You've got this notion of director's theater, mm-hmm. where the director is going to take the play and then create his own artwork from it. And that happens a lot with Shakespeare because it's in the public domain and he's not going to complain.
It could be her artwork.
Shakespeare was a woman?
No, director's.
Oh, her. Yes,
director's so, his.
Yes. Yes, I'm using the universal his, which also means her.
No.
His or her artwork?
Depends what your definition of his is.
His or her. So the director is creating their vision using, you know, the play. So, you know, you get these productions, you know, very concept-driven. You know, you've set Merchant of Venice in the ghetto in 1936. And mm-hmm. I went to see a production of Much Ado About Nothing the RSC did a few years ago in London. It was a really good production. But for some reason, it was set in Sicily in 1931, and there were about five pages in the beginning of the program that talked about why this was, you know, and all the corollaries, and then really all that happened was someone drove a motorbike on stage to start with, and it was like sort of before the Second World War, and then everything else was just like normal, and they were using those clothes. But I find that does lead the audience to start trying to read things into it that aren't necessarily there. So we try to create as much of a neutral world as we can, or choose a period that, you know, like Twelfth Night, sort of Downton Abbey-esque. Mm-hmm. We use that, but we're not actually asking you to, you know, we're not setting it on the right. Titanic. Wait a minute.
I like
brilliant.
That idea. Well, I think sometimes those productions work amazingly. It's not, I wouldn't even say that it's necessarily
sometimes
a bad thing.
Sometimes they do, but it's just, you know, it's when it becomes the rule rather than the exception, then, it has sort of taken over in a way. When we first put our first production on, in New York, the person that was renting us the theater said, "So tell me, what's your concept?" And I said, "Here's the concept. There's no concept." He goes, "Oh, wow, that's deep."
So meta.
So, you know, when we're looking around for a period, I mean, with two gents just, you know, setting it in a sort of rockabilly style thing, we're thinking about, you know, how it's a play about teenage rebellion. And, you know, that's something that sort of fits neatly there. We also have some good musicians in the company that we know that we can really pull off that kind of music, and that will be fun to do. But beyond that, we're not going to, you know, it's not really, you know, like we're presenting Zoot Suit or something that actually has, you know, a real message behind it.
Right. Well, I also think it's just the nature of Shakespeare. Shakespeare as a writer was completely uninterested in verisimilitude. Didn't matter to him as a writer and as a, you know, at the, you know, the, they would have worn Renaissance clothes with a toga over it. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't trying to tell the audience this is ancient Greece. So I think when you decide when a Shakespeare production, I think it can work, and you can create your own version of something, and it can be really terrific. But the text of the plays, it's for us, because we do really, I should say, except last year with Richard III, where we added a whole other playwright's work to it. But we tend to, we really do try to not stick to the text, but we regard Shakespeare as our primary collaborator. So as we're kind of in dialogue with Shakespeare, we're trying to get close to the intentions of him as a playwright as well. And so when you start sort of reducing the possibility of the play by the design choices you're making, you just have to be really aware that that's what's happening. And so you have to be really, really confident and secure that what the end result is going to be is worth this reduction of possibility. And sometimes it is. I mean, I think you can have these very, you know, important productions that really draw a clear parallel that are very powerful. Yeah, but it's tricky to do, I think, in a way that doesn't diminish the play.
It almost sounds like sometimes the setting for you is more of kind of setting a touchstone for a feeling or a vibe in the audience, just so that they, because I remember, I don't know if it was 2 or 3 years ago, The Taming of the Shrew, I think it was like late 50s, early 60s,
it was kind of
Italy.
Fellini-esque was kind of
exactly.
Our feeling.
Yeah. So that was very effective to kind of, well, for those of us who were old enough to know what those films are, you know, to bring us into that world.
And I think, I mean, it helps. And I think the idea too is to kind of, you want to create a theatrical, we talk about it, I think, I guess the words we use mostly is we're creating a theatrical world that's based on or influenced by or a reflection of Fellini, these Fellini films. But you don't want to get sort of too far down that road, because then you find that starts to say, but then you can't do this, or this role gets in action. But it does help, I would say, I think it does help making a cohesive aesthetic, because, you know, if you're going to buy a coffee cup, it helps to know what coffee cup to buy in a world of a lot of coffee cups. And I do think sometimes with some of our productions, they've been so kind of, especially initial ones where we really had no money.
We used to have this grandma's attic thing. It's set in grandma's attic.
It's set just in an attic, and whatever you need, it's right there. And we're gonna. And there are certain things, like, you know, the jacket, like the sweater that was in every production for about 10 years. Like somebody was wearing the sweater, or somebody was using this, you know, I don't know, whatever, a golf bag, the golf bag. How many shows was that golf bag in? So I do think that it's something we think about, but we do, as David says, we don't necessarily as a company produce quite that style of theater. I think I like that style of theater a little more than David likes that style of theater.
Well, but that's one of the things that becomes a limitation for the actors when you get there and, you know, I mean, and you say, well, your character looks like this, and your character, you know, he works as an undersecretary to this person, and, you know, I did a production in London where the guy normally designed operas, and he says, your character is very slovenly and has very greasy hair, so you will put, you know, he gave me a big tub of hair grease and said, you'll put this in your hair every night. And I don't see this character like this at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was at war with this man, you know. And, you know, eventually I got my way, but it didn't get asked back to that theatre.
Okay, so we know that this summer is going to be Measure for Measure and Two Gentlemen of Verona, but I also know that right now you're in the midst of what you call the Iambic Lab. So can you kind of tell us what that's all about and how that became to be?
We had been doing classical plays for some time, and primarily in LA we were doing them outdoors. And then we had been rehearsing anywhere we could find rehearsal space. This will come back to your question, I promise. I know I sound like I've gone down a big, big thing. And we would often, you know, rent, was it Second City that we would rent?
Mm-hmm.
On Hollywood Boulevard. And at the time we lived out in the West Valley, which for those of you not in Los Angeles, that's quite a distance. And you couldn't leave anything in the rehearsal place. So we had all our stuff in a trunk, a big road box that we still have somewhere. And for whatever reason, one day, I was alone in the van. I'd driven to rehearsal. I'd gotten this road box out of the van on my own. I was pushing it down Hollywood Boulevard. And that was, I always think, that's the day, like, that was the straw that broke this camel's back. Because I thought, it's as good as we've gotten. We're not going to get any better making it like this. It's so chaotic, such upheaval for the actors, you know. You never have the right prop in the right place to practice. And we started thinking about rehearsal, and we were really looking for somewhere to rehearse the place and for the summer shows. And we found this space that we're in now, which is our studio, and rented it, right? And then basically just started rehearsing.
Very expensive.
It felt very expensive to us.
And
then we thought, we better pay for this somehow. We should probably put on some plays. So we started doing plays indoors in this space. We didn't even have the idea that we would be doing seasons. It was just sort of we were trying to make
them. We started out doing classes, and then we thought, hey, wait a minute, we could probably put some seats in here. And then we tried doing a show in here, and then before we knew it, we were running a season. And then we were stupid enough to start paying people to do it. So after a while, it wasn't paying for the space, but we were running a small professional theater indoors and a big one outdoors. Anyway, sorry.
And so, so we had to start thinking about what are we doing in the theater? And I think we were trying to figure out, well, are we just doing classic plays? Do we have to find other classical plays by other authors? And we spent a couple of years trying to figure out what was happening. But in that time while we were doing that, we started developing some plays. Either, you know, a musical David wrote, and then we also worked on a project that a company member had brought to us. And we found that we really liked working on new work. It was a nice balance to working on 400-year-old plays. It was really nice to have plays where the playwright was in the room to ask questions of and so on. So we started thinking about how can we support new works. So last year we did our first Iambic Lab, and it was strictly play readings of new works or new adaptations of classical plays. And they were kind of on classical themes, sort of. And we liked that, but we felt like something was kind of missing in it. And so this year, and I really like how it's kind of grown now. We're thinking of it sort of as a sort of a month-long celebration of how we make theater. And so we've had a version, we've had some play readings, some works in progress, some classes, open classes where we've gotten to know our audience a little bit better. And it still has that sense of development, but it's development of artists, development of new works, and development of audiences. So that's really what it is now. And so this time we've had our... I think it's a really great balance of works in progress,
yeah,
readings of new works, We have a screening of a film, which is an amazing film for anyone who's listening, called Still Dreaming, which is about a production of Midsummer Night's Dream that was done in the Lillian Booth at Home for Retired Actors. So it's a Midsummer Night's Dream with quite senior performers. And it's by a pair of filmmakers that did Shakespeare Behind Bars, if you've ever seen that. It's the same filmmakers. And it's one of the things that's kind of interesting about that film is the man who stars as Bottom in the production used to be our upstairs neighbor in New York.
No way.
Isn't that strange? We were very excited to see Harold starring in a play. It was so great. So that's really what sort of Iambic Lab is. And then coming up in the spring is a new production of a brand or a new American play.
Second only production. It's been on Broadway with us. Never been anywhere else.
From Broadway
to
this 49-seat theater.
And it's a play by a friend of ours called Shah White, who, when I first came to America after we finished Hamlet, we were working with a group of actors that sort of, you know, inspired the beginning of Independent Shakespeare Company. And part of that was working on this group. What was it called? I can't remember what the name of the group was, but they would choose...
Pulse or something
like that. No, it was... But they would choose... The writers would write for the group of actors that they had. So there were about four or five of us acting in it. And then we did a couple of one-act plays, and Shah wrote one of those. And that's how we got to know him. We've been in touch ever since. And he's gone on to become really very successful playwright. He's had a couple of plays on Broadway now. And his play, what is it called? The Other Room?
The Other Place.
The Other Place, sorry. In tons of regional theatres. And he also writes for the TV show The Affair. You know, he's an old friend, but it's great to be collaborating with him again on this. And
he's actually taken the Broadway script and restored some scenes that got cut from the original that he missed and reworked some stuff. So it's I wouldn't say it's not a new play, but it's actually a new version of the play, which is kind of, I don't know, exciting to do. And it's a beautiful script, and it's a really sort of an American family at the end of an era. It takes place in 1917, but it has Shar kind of talks about the play. It should feel like a period play that's been done many, many, many times. This is now being done by a modern director. Speaking of director's theater, he wants us to have a feeling of director's theater, because for him it's a play about contemporary issues, but it's just set in 1917.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff about immigration in it, and how one era ends and a new one begins. You know, so it's about the epochal shifts and what that does to the psyche, and it's kind of where we are right now, I think.
Yes, it is. It's interesting that you talk about Snow Geese, because I was looking at the upcoming schedule, and I was wondering how you found that piece, because it just seemed to be just out of the blue, this new play. So Iambic Lab, very much part of development. Do you see pieces from Iambic Lab becoming full productions in future years?
Yes. Okay. I think that's definitely part of the vision of it, is not that there's a rule that might happen, but that it's a great place to allow, particularly the people, the artists we work with, an opportunity to present an unfinished work or to present a version. You know, last year we had a great translation of a Feydeau piece that's never done here that was really funny. Someday down the road I'd love to produce. What we have coming up, we have two of our company members have worked on solo pieces, and they are both kind of about their families and about their families being not from America, and in the different ways that means. And I think that's something we'd be really interested in helping both of them bring that to a full production as well. So I think it's for sure, it's not that it's a rule that something we do now, we're going to do then, but we definitely look at it as a place to allow the artists that we kind of have been working with another opportunity to create.
Yeah, and we just did a reading of Ibsen's The Pretenders, which I think has only ever had one professional production in the US, and it's a new translation by Charles Pogue, who wrote the screenplay for The Fly and lots of other.
And lots of theatrical, theatrical adaptation he's done a lot of too as well.
And, you know, which would be great to produce, but it's, you know, it's a huge cast. It, you know, unfortunately would be probably beyond our budget here, but it was really nice to be able to read it,
right.
Experiment with what that would be like, and fun to put that work before an audience. It's like, you know, a side of Ibsen that I'd never seen before. It's good. It's a platform for us to really sort of experiment and just without too much risk, try things.
I think in our indoor work, we've tended to gravitate towards either versions of classical plays or plays that are somehow influenced by classical forms. Kalyan's play that is one of the ones that we'll be workshopping on this coming up this week. Her father is Cambodian, and he's a composer, and she's learned, you know, composed a song for her, and she's learned traditional Cambodian instrument to play with it. She's learning Khmer, she's learning Cambodian performance techniques. And so that's classical theater. It's just mm-hmm. not Western classical right. theater. So for us too, it's also a place where we can kind of, well, what does it mean to say something's classical? I don't think you would probably come to one of her plays and see, I don't know what. We probably wouldn't put on, I'm trying to think what that idiom was.
Dial M for Murder.
Well, that wasn't what I was thinking, but I was more, you know, we probably wouldn't put on a play that's, you know, two people in a hotel room talking about, you know, I don't know. Not that that's bad. It's just there's a lot of forms for that. Whereas the Snow Geese Char is really working on the classical idiom of realism mm-hmm. and then subverting it and then having scenes that would never occur in a play of realism right. that suddenly just happen and then it causes you kind of, do you know what I mean? So he's working very much within a classical form. Oh, dear.
Pickles?
Is that a sneeze?
No, Pickles doesn't know. You don't like realism. Is that what you're saying? Is that
She's
what you're telling
trying
us?
Trying to find snacks.
As we kind of process, well, what does it mean for us to produce theater indoors? Mm-hmm. That's what we've tended to gravitate towards.
We tend to really want to explore things that use the full potential of theater to be an imaginative world. So modern plays that, you know, take place on one set, you know, with two people, because, you know, it's cheap to write. I mean, there's a lot of modern plays that are like that. They're very small casts and they take place on a unit set, and, you know, they essentially could be a TV episode or something,
right.
And it's not to say that's not great drama, and you know, there's definitely the place for it, but that's not here. We really want to, you know, there's the epic Shakespearean world that we deal with in the summer, and then, you know, in this little space here, we try and, you know, explore the boundaries of that kind of theatre.
And I think we're also really guided by kind of the essential humane nature of Shakespeare. You know, Shakespeare had a great empathy for the human experience. And even in his most nihilistic plays, you know, you're not left with, you know, nothing. Whereas I do think there is a trend now. I mean, I've seen some contemporary plays that I've really admired, but I leave feeling just like crap about being a person.
Right.
You know, everything is hopeless and it's awful and we're just terrible. We're terrible, terrible people. And I do not like to go to the theater for that. I feel like for me, is not something I find really satisfying. Mm-hmm. I find it frightening and it keeps me up at night. And maybe that's good, but I also find the news frightening and it keeps me up at night. And I personally don't necessarily also want to go to the theater. In the theater, I'm looking for communion and connection and a sense of possibility. And I think Shakespeare, I can't imagine anyone who loved the human, you know, the complexity of the human nature more. You know, there's just a central sort of humane quality, and the people that he has, no, really the only people, David pointed this out, and I think it's just one of the truest things I've ever heard, is the only people Shakespeare really has no empathy for are hypocrites. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing that mm-hmm. he just finds, like Malvolio or, you know,
bigots. People who try to impose their, you know, their ideology on somebody else.
Yeah.
That's who he has no time for.
Right.
And
Richard III, Iago,
everyone, well, Iago, I don't know, but you know, he doesn't seem empathetic with Iago. But he creates a world where kindness wins in that play, in a way. I mean, does it? I don't know. Maybe I'm just reading into it, but I think that So for me too, I guess as we look for new works, we're also looking for works that kind of provoke a sense of communion and connectedness and empathy.
So you were saying that usually by the end of one summer season, you know what the next season's going to be and that you kind of have a three-year plan mapped out. What about for the indoor season? Is it the same way, or is it much more a case of flying with, not necessarily by the seat of your pants, but much closer to the dates that these pieces are actually going to appear?
I think we're learning about that. We are figuring out what that means. We've had years where it's been really planned 18 months before, this year we're doing a little bit less in the next 18 months.
Yeah, I think we're trying to
figure out how to have enough space for a whim or an innovation or this thing happened. Wouldn't it be great if we could workshop this for 2 weeks to leave enough space that there is opportunity for that, but also have enough structure that you can actually market things and you can actually get an audience or raise money for it or that kind of thing. So it's
a question of doing,
working on it,
doing things when it's the right time to do them, as opposed to running set seasons indoors. So I think in the next few years that might look a little erratic in terms of how we produce things, because I think we're going to try and concentrate on doing the best quality work rather than trying to put out an enormous amount of output, which is what we've been doing in the last few.
Leave more space, I think, too, for developing things that might not go anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, this is I think the idea of the indoor space really is about it being a laboratory to
it's a studio. That's what they call it, and it for the past few years, I think you're right, it started to feel more like a really small regional theater with no lobby.
Yeah, right.
and we're not really cut out for that, and we certainly don't have the staff for that at the moment.
No, and there are other theaters in LA that are doing that. We don't really want to be in that game, and we have the park as the flagship thing that we do every summer, and that's the thing that people know us for. But I think it would be great if we can be creating things here that can potentially go on to have another life in other spaces. And that would be that's a goal that we definitely want to work towards.
Again, thanks to Melissa and David for carving out some time from their busy schedules to discuss their new season as well as the Iambic Lab. So be on the lookout, or would that be listen out, for the third and final part of this interview, in which you'll hear more about the logistics of putting on a season of Shakespeare. Need some teaching resources? Need to adorn your teaching materials with some Shakespearean goodies? Well, check out the Bill Shakespeare Project page on the teacherspayteachers.com site. We've got materials on Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar, King Lear, Othello, Troilus and Cressida, and Titus Andronicus, with more on the way all the time. Plus, you can find the handout version of the periodic table of Shakespeare. Now, some are free, some are for purchase, but all quality items. And for those of you who are asking for bigger poster-sized versions of that periodic table, you can order those from our Redbubble page. Links to both pages can be found in the navigation of this here website.
So, it's over. The production I'd been working on for the last 3 months has come to an end. Much Ado About Nothing closed last Sunday. Now, back in the day when I taught high school English and Shakespeare at Oxnard High School, I had the luck of working with some very, very talented students. Many of them went on to continue doing drama, which is just this much, I'm holding my thumb and forefinger very close to one another, less rewarding or pride-inducing than watching students go on and get into the teaching profession. Now, one of those former students, Jo Lynn, had ended up majoring in theater, and she had been producing at the local theater for a while now. She was one of the first of my students to contact me when I joined Facebook, and occasionally she would let me know if there was a show that she thought I might want to be a part of. But I never took her up on it. Now, part of it was having been so long off the stage. I haven't been on an acting stage for, if memory serves, 25 years. Teaching? Sure. Presentations? Absolutely. In-services and workshops? Yeah, but acting in character? Decades. I wasn't sure if I could do it. I also wasn't sure if I could do it because I would often bail from prospective auditions out of
well, fear, I guess. The anxiety panic attacks that I've been suffering from with increasing and alarming frequency, save for the ones that are absolutely directly related to grief, seem to have had one thing in common: the necessity of me being in an unfamiliar surrounding with people I don't know. Wow, I can't believe I'm admitting this on a broadcast, but anyway. Last fall, when Much Ado was announced, she sent me another invite, and I made the mistake of mentioning it to my wife Lisa, and she made me commit to going. I only wanted to see if I could help out from a dramaturgical point of view, but I was convinced to audition. Now, working with Vivian, our director, has been a wonderful experience. I tried to help her achieve her objectives. We cut lines and sections that modern audiences just wouldn't get. We moved a section of Act 2, Scene 1 to the beginning of the play to allow for a sequence that would let the audience be drawn into the Regency period before being saddled with Shakespeare. She wanted a tonal shift after the interval, so we cut the Dogberry Watch introduction / Baraccio capture scene into two parts, and we put the first half before the Don John revelation to Pedro and Claudio, which then ended the first act with a dumb show of what Claudio sees. The second act could then begin with the capture without the bizarrely out-of-place comedy. Now, there were some decisions I didn't agree with, and we talked those out. She made the final call as director, and I think for the most part her instincts were better than my overthinking on the matters. But I think the show was better for those discussions, or at least I like to fool myself into thinking so. The cast and crew were an absolute joy to work with. The four romantic leads were exceptional. Our Don John was wonderfully intense, Dogberry and Virgis hilarious. But for me, as the character Antonio, it was Mark, as my brother Leonardo, who made my job possible. I was incredibly rusty to start, and he was able to coax a better performance out of me. And by the end of the run, our characters were truly acting as brothers on stage. It was exhilarating. The run of 5 weeks has had some ups and downs. A performance for 200 ninth graders, definitely an up. A canceled performance due to the rain, not so much. Then there was the Sunday matinee, poorly attended with an old couple sitting dead center of the theater. The man could not hear, so his wife would tell him what was going on. But remember, the man could not hear, so she was pretty much shouting. The problem, as if that wasn't it to begin with, was that she was getting the story wrong. It was a tad distracting. This last weekend of performances, however, have been some of the best of our run, with crowds that really pushed us, gave us energy. And for me, it's been something extra special, as my older son Kyle flew out to surprise me and Lisa for our birthdays. She's another March baby, as is our younger son Jack, and to catch the show. And it's been wonderful. And now it's over. Some of the actors want to put together regular play readings, and I'll definitely participate in those. Jolynn's directing later this year, and I'll be involved offstage doing ops or assisting with the stage management. Will I act again? Sure, if the right show comes along. And no, it doesn't have to be Shakespeare, but the Bard would probably mean an automatic audition. But I'm a cliche. What I really want to do is direct. And I've got a couple of ideas, so we shall see. I'm thankful for having been able to be a part of this show. And I'll end rambling now. Now, if you've been enjoying this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries since our last regular podcast, you've missed out on subjects including Pericles, the wrap-up, a new month, a new play, Coriolanus, Coriolanus Act 1, Part 1, battle lines drawn and crossed, last chance to see Much Ado, Coriolanus Act 1, Part 2, a victory and a name bestowed, Coriolanus authorship, Much Ado About Something Ending, Coriolanus Act 2, in a dislikability contest, everyone loses. Sources: Go North, Old Man, and Coriolanus Act 3, This Is Not Going to End Well. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, Check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page or Twitter feed. Remember, though, that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again for our next podcast next week when we'll kick off Coriolanus with a plot synopsis and intro. Hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for March the 12th, 2017. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.